Welcome to Looks Like New on KGNU's It's the Economy. Looks Like New is a show that asks old questions about new tech. We join you every month on the old-fashioned radio, or you can listen online as a podcast. Looks Like New is a production of the Media Economies Design Lab at CU Boulder. This month, our guest is Marjorie Kelly, who has helped build movements like ethical investing, corporate social responsibility, benefit corporations, and worker ownership. She believes that well-meaning people have inadvertently reinforced the problems within corporations, reluctant to see themselves as part of a unified next system beyond capitalism. In this interview, hosted by Nathan Schneider as a live event which includes insightful audience interaction, Kelly draws on the lessons of her career, including her mistakes, calling for a movement that refuses to take the current system for granted. Please enjoy this production of Nathan Schneider, Marjorie Kelly, and the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder.
I want to officially welcome Marjorie Kelly into the space. Marjorie, thank you so much for being here.
Nathan, thanks so much. I'm really excited about this conversation.
Well, I want to begin just by situating your work, catching us up to speed on your career as a whole and where this latest book fits into it. So I wonder if you could just start by talking a bit about how you found yourself first interested in economic questions to begin with. And,
sure.
Through the founding of Business Ethics Magazine, what first made you want to be involved in this space?
Yeah, I come to this work as a journalist. I was trained as a journalist, and I was working at a publishing company in charge of new projects. And I was reading widely in the management literature. This was the 1980s, and I saw something interesting happening. It was South African divestment was happening, which helped to bring down apartheid, new theories of management, socially responsible investing, business ethics. And I thought, you know, this isn't my father's business. I'd like to put myself in the middle of that and help this new mind of business to grow. And so I started Business Ethics Magazine. It was a magazine of socially responsible business and investing. And I started that in 1987. And, you know, my initial goal, Nathan, was to celebrate the positive. I thought there's so many people who want to tear down capitalism and there's so much anti-business. I want to celebrate the positive. I want to talk about the people who are doing things differently. And I really believed then that good business people and good investors could change the world. And I published that magazine for 20 years, and I became increasingly discouraged over that time as I saw businesses that I had given business ethics awards to resorting to mass layoffs. We're talking sometimes tens of thousands of workers, and that never used to happen. You would see businesses sending jobs overseas and demanding tax breaks just to stay in a community they'd been in for 100 years. Suddenly they needed the tax break to stay. And I began to see that the problem couldn't be solved by individuals because the problem was in the system. It was in this deep system. And so I sold business ethics and I went to TELUS Institute, and Alan White and I there started a project. Well, I wrote Divine Right of Capital. That was my first book to talk about, you know, the nature of the problem. And it's really about, you know, capital supremacy. And Alan White and I, who was the founder of the Global Reporting Initiative, he had come to a similar point of discouraging. I mean, you can have all this sustainability reporting, but it doesn't really touch the core of the system. So we did Corporation 2020 and gathered 100 experts over many years to talk about how would you design corporations differently. If designing for maximum profits is the problem, how would you design them differently? And Owning Our Future came out of that work. I talked about various companies and how they can be designed differently. And, you know, in fact, J. Cohen Gilbert told me that the Divine Right of Capital inspired him to start the B Corp movement. So I was thrilled about that. But I keep becoming discouraged, Nathan, because you know, despite so many visionary people, thousands all over the world have really worked out how to make it a more democratic economy. And yet we're losing ground faster than we're gaining it. And that's, it's led me to this current book.
I resonate with that feeling deeply. And, you know, I find myself in that, you know, that kind of emotional and also analytic moment of, you know, we've been trying so many things, and that sense of losing more ground than we're gaining feels very real to me in my work with cooperatives and mm-hmm. you know, other kinds of mutualist businesses. You know, when we were planning this, you agreed to the title of Where I Went Wrong, which is a really, I think a very, really brave thing to do. And that came out of our conversations and our discussions about what you really see this book as being about. Where would you say that happened? Where do you say, looking back, that you first went wrong?
Well, I think, you know, possibly the most dramatic example of where I went wrong. You know, I was like many of us in the field, and many still today are doing this. We're trying to make the business case. We're trying to show how, for example, ESG, or what used to be called socially responsible investing, can actually deliver better returns. And so, you know, we're trying to talk the language of the system and say, this is a better way. This is a better way to maximize your profits. And I published this article in 2004, and it was called The Holy Grail Found, Absolute Definitive Proof That Corporate Social Responsibility Pays Off. And this was in Business Ethics. And I'm going to grab this here in the book. So it was like something like, I said, and I'm not finding it quickly here, but it, you know, there were a couple of meta studies over, they had looked over 20 years, hundreds of studies, and they showed companies that are superior in corporate social responsibility deliver better returns for shareholders. And I'm like, we've got it. This is the Holy Grail. And what I've seen since then is it makes no difference. The system really subsumes our efforts into itself. And here's the really tragic example of that. Social reporting agencies, and these look at how are companies performing on various social metrics, ecological metrics, and they report on this for investors. And the main one of these firms is MSCI. Well, MSCI, there was a big expose by Business Week not too long ago, and MSCI, you know, so as so many of us tried to make the business case over really decades, a group like MSCI finally took us at its word, and it is now acts as though maximum profits is the only aim of ESG. And so you look at, for example, when they rate a company on water stress, right? And let's say a company gets a better score on water stress. Well, you would think that means this company is putting less stress on water systems, right? Well, no, that's not what it means. What it means is that company is going to have adequate water in order to sustain production. So the whole idea of social impact has been inverted. You want to maintain water so that companies can maintain their production. And this is the exact opposite of what ESG was supposed to mean. And I, you know, I feel like I aided and abetted this swindle because I was out there making the business case. And George Lakoff, who's a linguist theorist linguistic habits, we shall say, he says that when you invoke the frame, you reinforce the frame. So when we're out there saying, hey, you can make better profits by being sustainable, what we're saying is the only thing that matters is profit. And by the way, you will never have to sacrifice a dime of gains to investors in order to be responsible. And it's a hoax, Nathan. And I'm sorry that I aided and abetted it. There are other examples of failure, but that's the first one that I would point to on my part.
Well, I feel that we, you know, and I think many of us in, you know, if we call it a movement for economic justice through, you know, redesigning business through kind of ethical investing or through things like cooperatives and these kinds of movements. I mean, in so many cases, we found ourselves often unexpectedly, perhaps complicit in things that we never meant to be complicit in. But looking back, we can see, oh, you know, the lines are there. You just need to connect the dots. And I think that's a very powerful example.
Yeah. So let me give a couple of other examples because Robin Wall Kimmerer, and she wrote this wonderful book, Braiding Sweetgrass. She says, we are called to a movement of equal parts outrage and love. And I think for a long time, I wanted to only do the love part. I wanted to only be positive. And I think many of us have that impulse. And it's, I've been a student of Buddhism, and I think we want to be the solution, but we're missing the outrage, and things are getting worse and worse and worse because we're reluctant, I think, to marry the outrage to the love, and we need to find a way to do that. And let me give you a couple of examples of how the system, in this large system, which is, you know, maximum capital extraction, this is the system of wealth supremacy that I call it. Wealthy people matter more than anybody else, and maximizing their portfolios is the aim of the economy. I mean, that's wealth supremacy. When we leave that system intact and we do our little stuff on the side that's so positive and so wonderful, and it is wonderful, and it is what we need, the big system devours what we build. And let me give you two examples of that. The first one is CDFIs, Community Development Financial Institutions. It's the world's worst title. CDFIs.
There are worse ones.
I love CDFIs. There's 1,000 of them around the country, and they're you know, these are financial institutions that are deliberately aiding the disadvantaged, and they're doing it through lending and through banking or loan funds. So it's a wonderful example of using the tools for positive ends. Well, the CEO of the Democracy Collaborative, where I am now, Stephanie McHenry, she used to be the president of Shore Bank Cleveland. And Shore Bank in Chicago and its sister organizations was the very first CDFI. It was the bank on which the whole idea of CDFIs was modeled, right? And so Stephanie was out there doing good loans in disadvantaged neighborhoods, mostly neighborhoods of color, in Cleveland. This is up to 2008. And then predatory capital moved in and started pitching predatory mortgages. And she said they would put flyers on people's doors. You know, it was all seemed very appealing. Get some cash out of your house. And as we know, predatory capital nearly sank the global economy. And in the process, Shore Bank was destroyed. And this was one of the, you know, the premier CDFI, and it was brought down. So who's now buying? Okay, so the big banks were bailed out, as we know, and the homeowners were left to suffer, and many of them were homeowners of color. Well, who's out there buying these foreclosed properties? Well, it's private equity. So it's another form of predatory finance. They're right now buying 1 in 5 homes in Cincinnati, and they're raising rents, neglecting maintenance, and doing aggressive evictions in order to maximize returns for their shareholders. And so that's the system out there devouring what we build. And, you know, so it's wonderful to have CDFIs. There's 1,000 of them, but most of them are really tiny, maybe $100 million in assets. There's one or two that are big and substantial, but it's pretty tiny stuff. So that's one example of it devouring what we build. Here's another one, and this is really hits home for me. Like you, Nathan, I've been working for employee ownership for many years now. It's one of the models that feels most ready for scale.
I was hoping this would be your second example.
Yes, it's most ready for scale. I mean, the evidence is there. 1/4 as many workers are laid off. These companies are more resilient in a downturn. Workers come away with more than 100,000 in retirement savings. I mean, there's just, you know, the evidence is just overwhelming that these are superior companies. Jessica Rose and I at Democracy Collaborative, she's now with the GIN, but we did research and found that what's really needed is, so I see the question, which companies are superior? Worker-owned companies are superior. They are more resilient, more profit for workers. They actually are more profitable. So on many, many measures, worker-owned companies are superior to investor-owned companies. And so the research that we did at the Democracy Collaborative found that a key missing piece is we need active capital. I mean, if you want to sell your business, you need somebody on the other side who's going to step forward and go, I've got money out. Let me buy your business. I'll transition it to worker ownership. We need those kinds of funds. And we found a dozen of them. We helped design the Fund for Employee Ownership at Evergreen Cooperatives in Cleveland, a network of worker-owned firms. And so I was very excited about the role of capital in taking employee ownership to scale. And then lo and behold, who enters the scene but private equity? And private equity has started a project called Ownership Works. And there's, I don't know, two dozen private equity firms involved. And they give a little bit of equity to workers for a relatively short time, maybe 5 years. And then the companies are flipped and sold and workers are quite likely to be laid off. But, you know, they might get $100,000 in the meanwhile. And so the momentum for capital and employee ownership is coming from private equity. And they can move, of course, billions of dollars, whereas these little funds like the Fund for Employee Ownership, I think, is 15 million. And so really, employee ownership is being, in a way, taken over by private equity, which, so what I realized the mistake that I made in here was I failed to emphasize that employee ownership is part of system change. You know, it's not just about putting a little bit of wealth in workers' hands while you leave the extractive system in place. I mean, private equity is in the business of destroying jobs. It has destroyed 1.3 million retail jobs in 10 years. It's in the business of bankrupting companies. Toys R Us was bankrupted by private equity, and 33,000 workers lost their jobs. And, you know, so for private equity to be saying we're now doing employee ownership, that's like ExxonMobil putting solar panels on top of its factories, right? You know, it's not getting to the heart of the matter. And so I think what I have determined is that I'm interested in employee ownership as a part of system change. And the system change is what we really need to emphasize now. Otherwise, it's going to devour everything. So let me just stay on that point for a minute. There's something that I wrote recently. I said, you know, the problem is in the system. The system is the mind that says, I'm going to maximize returns for capital at any cost, in any way I can. That's the system, right? I mean, you could take every billionaire, every hedge fund manager, every private equity executive, and if aliens abducted them tomorrow, add the corporate CEOs in there, nothing would change. The system would just reconstitute itself. I mean, where the soul of the system lives is in the mind of the system. And until we turn and attack that, and I mean attacking the idea, I don't like to attack people, but we need to attack this idea that a system exists to make wealthy people wealthier. That's illegitimate. And until we challenge that, I think that our efforts are doomed to fail.
And so that I think is really important to emphasize, right? We're not talking about necessarily like a broad ideology, right? Capitalism versus something else, right? We're talking about a precise diagnosis that you're offering here about what the core danger is, which is this wealth supremacy trap, this profit maximization at all costs trap, this legal and cultural complex that says and licenses, you know, profit maximization at all costs, right? Mm-hmm. So then, you know, when you talk about attacking that idea, what does that attack look like? What is, you know, you know, where do you go beyond trying to support more cooperatives or something like that at the margins?
Yeah.
You know, where is the attack surface?
Well, of course, we still need to support worker cooperatives. We need worker ownership. We need CDFIs. I mean, that's
thank you.
That's the next system. So, I mean, I think we need to, so a couple of things. How do you attack it? Well, you publish a book called Wealth Supremacy. You say, let's name it. It's a system of bias. It's a bias toward wealthy people and against the rest of us and against the environment and against society. So we need to recognize that it's a bias, that it's not a, it casts itself as a technical necessity, a benign process. And so I have chapters in there, and I talk about the seven myths of wealth supremacy. And the first one is that no amount of wealth is ever enough, right? This is the premise of investing. You know, Bill Gates had, at one point, had $10 billion, which is more money than any of us could even conceive of spending in 100 lifetimes. And what did he do? He invested it. And within 20 years, he had $300 billion. Now, isn't that absurd? It's like saying if your plate is full, and in fact, your house is full, what do? Well, you go out and you get, you know, 10 more houses filled with food. I mean, when do we realize that this is gluttony and this is absurd and this is illegitimate? It's hoarding. But we don't see that because we believe that no amount of wealth is ever enough. A couple of other ideas. One is fiduciary duty, this idea that investor managers have an obligation to maximize returns for shareholders. They have to protect investor interests and put investors first. And there's a lot of truth to that, right? You don't want, you don't want someone taking your investment dollars and giving it to their crazy Uncle Harry or running off to the Bahamas. So yes, so there's a certain amount of legitimacy and importance to this concept of fiduciary duty. But tucked in there is this other idea, which says only gains to capital matter, nothing else matters. If you're going to trash the environment, if you're going to ruin workers' lives, if you're going to abandon communities so they fall into rust belt disrepair, none of that matters. All that matters is maximizing gains to capital. And that's the tautology of capital bias that's kind of tucked in there in this seemingly benign, technically legal term, fiduciary duty. So what I do in these chapters is I unpack how these seemingly benign terms and concepts really obscure and yet carry this notion of, I call it capital bias, a bias toward capital, or I call it wealth supremacy. So exposing, you're saying, what do? Name it as illegitimate, expose it for how it's hiding in the system. And I think also show that there is another way. And I think this is the work that so many of us, I would imagine many people on this call are engaged in ethical business and investing and employee ownership and so on. So we need that. We need to show that another system is possible. But I think the thing that we as a movement need to add is that we need to take ourselves seriously as the next system and not just think of ourselves, well, I'm just building a few worker-owned firms. You know, we need to recognize we are the next system and take ourselves seriously that way.
Now, often when people think about system, policy comes to mind. And I'm curious about how much, I mean, I confess I found myself increasingly, you know, frustrated with what's possible in the market landscape. And so my mind goes to policy. You know, I keep mm-hmm. running into these barriers. And I, you know, sometimes worry about this. Am I just kind of asking, you know, daddy up in Washington to solve my problems for, right? But I'm curious about how you think about policy. You know, is this the crucial lever for addressing these concerns? I mean, you were talking about, for instance, you know, that fiduciary duty obligation, there's a kind mm-hmm. of quasi-legal tie there, but, you know, how far can policy get us around these things? You know, and what else needs to be part of this
yeah.
next system?
Well, I think it's interesting to make an analogy to feminism, right? So with feminism, you know, second wave feminism in the 1970s, you have women working against violence against women. You have people working for equal pay. You have people working for girls' athletics. But all of these aspects of the work saw themselves as united because they recognized sexism. They recognize male supremacy as the problem, right? So there's a unified recognition of this broad movement that has various arms. We need that, and I think we're lacking that at this point. That we tend to, you know, there's various aspects of what's happening, but we don't cohere as a movement. And I think it's because we lack this recognition of wealth supremacy and capital bias. That's what we're up against. That's what the problem is, right? So I think cultural awareness is a really key piece. I don't think that feminism could really have made the advances it made if it just went for Title IX funding for athletic for girls, or if it just went for ERA, which we never got, right? The Equal Rights Amendment. So policy has a role, but I think cultural awareness is primary. And I think that we're at this sort of pre-awareness stage that the problem is in the system, and the nature of the problem is wealth supremacy or capital bias. That's the nature of the system. So we're at that stage. Now, that being said, I think that policy, and the right has taught us this a lot, you need to choose aspects of policy that kind of carry the message, right? So you need to advance policy, but you want to do it in a smart way that carries a much broader message. I think employee ownership is one of those. Is one of those policy initiatives. It needs, there's a bill out there, Employee Equity Something or Other Act. I always forget its kind of complicated name, but it's trying to give small business administration type backing for employee ownership conversion funds. So those funds are in the private sector, and they're coming out of, you know, maybe people on this call are starting those funds. And yet the role of policy is to accelerate what has been developed, I think, by the visionaries in the private sector. So I think policy has an important role. It's not the only tool, but it's probably where we need to go next, because I think what our movement has been good at is proof of concept. We know that CDFIs work. We know that worker-owned firms work. We know that, you know, public ownership of water works. And there's a movement now for public ownership of pharmaceuticals in California. So we have proof of concept. And so now we need to say we need to unify and we need to scale.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that's really powerful. And I really appreciate the, you know, the example of second wave feminism as a, you know, movement to learn from, in the sense that it was a broader and deeply cultural movement, one built on direct experience through small groups and communities, mm-hmm. And was able to develop a policy agenda that approached many aspects of society in ways that were relevant there. And even though, you know, the major legislative goal has still not been achieved, many, many pieces have been achieved that have really transformed society in profound ways. And, you know, I think also of the legacies like the rural electric cooperatives, right? Started as proofs of concept, you know, as you said, FDR saw those proofs of concept among farmers in upstate New York when he was governor of New York, and then becomes president and is able to see the plausibility of them for solving a major, you know, rural economic development problem. And then after they're implemented, wildly successful policy and financing, demonstrating you can finance cooperatives at large scale all over the country. And then, you know, in a lot of cases, the culture didn't keep up and didn't maintain, you know, the democratic spirit of those co-ops. And in some cases, they've been wildly successful. And in other cases, you know, they've kind of been sitting on their hands or worse. And it really has to be more than just policy. And I, you know, I love how you, you know, you center the ideas in this question.
Yeah, ideas are absolutely essential. And, it, you know, it's interesting to me, Nathan, that you started out by talking about my previous books, which were very, very positive. I was all about solutions and celebrating the visionaries who are developing different kinds of companies, you know, anchor purchasing, supporting things like the Evergreen Cooperatives, supported by large nonprofit hospital systems. So they're players in this. So one impact investors. I mean, there's various kinds of players, but with this book, Wealth Supremacy, I'm finding exponentially more interest because I think people respond to the problem. People know, we know that our system is rigged against us. I saw a survey, something like 70% of people realize the system is rigged, but we don't know how it's rigged, right? Because it's all obscure. And so I think by naming the problem clearly and challenging it, the legitimacy of it, not trying to tuck ourselves in it and say, oh, you'll make more profit if you're you're responsible, like I used to say. I think by naming the problem, it gives us a place to start, and it gives us that unifying impetus. That's my hope.
Thank you for that. I'm going to start transitioning toward voices other than mine to drive this conversation. So we have one question from Gordon Casey, really thoughtful question here. Gordon, I wonder if you could unmute and share your thoughts. And I'd also just like to invite others to please jump in the Q&A. Let us know if you want to participate, summarize what your thought is, and I'll bring you up as they come. So thank you so much. Gordon, take it away.
Thanks, Nathan. Thanks, Marjorie. I won't go on about it, but your work has also been very, very helpful to me. So I appreciate that. So we chat to a lot of groups who, super well-intentioned, trying to drive some increased impact in the space generally, but they're still talking about that hoax that you referred to. So yeah, they're maybe a little bit behind. And one of the things I've been searching for a long time, and I know I'm not the only one, but is a common language to distinguish what impact or social impact or whatever it is we're referring to, like what it is in this context you're talking about versus mm-hmm. where we sort of look at ESG and like carbon points and things like that. And I'm just curious, and obviously I haven't read your book yet, the new one, but I'm curious if you have language around that you think, or you, Nathan, either as well, to that we can use to both sort of stop those conversations where they're at and ensure that we have a shared understanding of what each of us is talking about, and to find each other, like for other people on this call, et cetera.
Well, first of all, I would say, Gordon, I've been, as a journalist and theorist, working in and tracking this space for more than 30 years. And I often say, I think 80% of the work is language. It's all about language. And so, I can't say that I have the perfect answer here. I will say, I talked about the extractive economy in a previous book, Owning Our Future, and that language has caught on. So, we can talk about non-extractive finance, for example, that's good language. And the other thing, on the other hand, I tried to float the idea of a generative economy, and that didn't catch on. So you don't know what's gonna catch on. But I think part of it is not just language, but being assertive. And that is turning and saying, we have to let go of the idea of maximizing returns to capital. We have to let go of that. I mean, if a corporation will do a move that is beneficial to sustainability and maybe it breaks even, well, isn't that good enough? I mean, why do gains to capital come before everything else? Now, I can sit here and say this, right, because we're friends on this call, and it's harder to have these conversations inside corporations or even with clients, if you're an investment manager. But I think those are the conversations we need to start having and challenging this idea that the so-called needs of capital always come first. I think that's the nature of the problem. I don't know.
Thanks, Marjorie. That is helpful. Yeah. Okay. Telling me to be assertive is always probably a wise thing.
It's hard.
I'm definitely not. So.
It's hard. I understand that. Yeah.
We have another thought here from Elias Krim, coming off of the Community Wealth Building Day in DC. Elias, do you want to take it away?
Hi, Marjorie. Just a question about your point about awareness, building cultural awareness. It seems that I mentioned here in DC, but as you know, also the city of Chicago has taken on community wealth building. You go on the city website. Wonderful. We're excited about it. We know that took a long time to happen. But, you know, that also, and I think that communicates something. It is a little abstract. It sounds like you're saying we need to get a little more militant. Wealth supremacy is an enemy. It's a theoretical enemy. But you're saying it's time to turn the heat up. You know, merely changing the paradigm is not enough. We need to have a different kind of edge in this. Am I hearing correctly in kind of the way you want to frame this?
Well, you know, it's a really interesting question, Elias, because, you know, our organization, the Democracy Collaborative, developed the phrase community wealth building. And we wrote the plan for Chicago. A couple of my colleagues, we wrote the community wealth building plan for Chicago. So community wealth building is a very powerful, positive phrase. And we find that people all over the world are drawn to it. Cities, mayors, we're doing some work in Amsterdam. We're doing work, beginning maybe to do some work in Los Angeles, and we've helped in Chicago. So community wealth building is great. And, you know, it's a debate we have in our own organization. I mean, how do you blend these two things? And it's very new, right? My book has been out for about a month and a half. But I think one of the ways, how would you make this visible? I mean, here's an example from Cincinnati. In Cincinnati right now, one in five homes are being bought by big capital. And they're bundling houses. You know, they big capital used to bundle mortgages for investors, right? To put all these mortgages together into these derivatives. Well, now they're doing it with houses and they're bundling them for investors. And how do they maximize profits? They raise rents, they neglect maintenance, and they do aggressive evictions. So the city of Cincinnati, via the Port Authority, which is its a financing arm, they floated a bond. They stepped in. They bought 200 homes from private equity, and they're going to keep rents. They're not going to raise rents. They're going to take care of neglected maintenance, and they're going to train renters in becoming homeowners. So what I like about that story is it shows, you know, that's Cincinnati's doing community wealth building. They're building community wealth, and they're also stopping the extraction. So I'm a storyteller, or I like to find stories that kind of carry the edge. And I think probably every city has those kind of stories, you know, that can help people understand, here's why community wealth building is so important. We're going to stop the extraction, and we're going to build wealth for all of us.
Yeah, I think that language takes different meanings in different places. I mean, as you're, you know, discussing that, I was thinking of, you know, the context where I live in Boulder, Colorado, which has a long history of setting itself up as kind of a gated community for wealth to accumulate. When I hear that language, you know, we have a center in community wealth building in Denver that is amazing, that does work in, you know, in immigrant communities. If that center were here, I would worry about it, because it could actually look like a kind of wealth supremacy. You know, when you talk about wealth building, it also is language that runs some of those risks that you've talked about for co-optation. And, you know, I wonder what other kinds of language you've been coming to in terms of what this next system's North Star is.
Well, at the Democracy Collaborative, we use the phrase the democratic economy. I mean, I think the jury is still out whether that's the right phrase. Some people use the well-being economy, the solidarity economy. I like democratic economy because it speaks to the issue of power. And it speaks to the issue of, we need a fully democratic society. Right now we have a society that's half plutocratic and half democratic. And I'm aware that I'm using sharp language. And I think it's after 30 years feeling discouraged of only doing the positive and seeing things get worse, gives me a sense of urgency. You know, the other thing I think is, we tend to talk about a free market economy, and I think that's a con, because it really implies that the alternative is unfreedom. And that's, of course, the narrative that the right wants us to have. Well, it's about freedom versus, you know, what, you know, communism is offering, which is lack of freedom. What we really have is a capital-centric economy. We have an extractive economy. It's all about maximum extraction for capital. And I think calling it what it is, an extractive economy, is is powerful language, and people get that. I find that language does catch on. There are efforts to talk about various forms of capital. We need natural capital, human capital. I'm uneasy with that language because what it says is that capital matters most, and we're going to tuck life itself into the frame of capital. Capital, life becomes a subset of capital. That makes me deeply uneasy. I don't think we should buy into that. I don't think we should refer to people in corporations as human capital. You know, they're workers. They should be members of the corporation. They should be owners. They're not tools to be used to create wealth for someone else. So, when we talk about someone's net worth, you know, what's your worth? That's coded language. And what that says is wealthy people are worth more than the rest of us, right? So I think our language is riddled with capital bias, with wealth supremacy bias. And we need to begin interrogating it and questioning it. And I think we're at an early stage of this, and there's a lot of work to be done on the issue of language.
I think it's a powerful thing to be able to say, actually, we thought we had the answers, but maybe we don't really have all the answers yet. The problem is bigger than we've been thinking. Artem has a question about accounting, which I think is interesting in light of, you know, your reference earlier to the B Corp movement and that sort of question. Artem, do you want to give voice to that?
Yes, thank you, Nathan. I hope you can hear me well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, like, how can we improve our thinking about, I don't know, externalities accounting or maybe value accounting? But I'm really interested in the notion of externalities. And I, you know, maybe you've heard of their so-called dark matter labs. They published an article, and basically they say that we should stop thinking about externalities because it's actually more about entanglements and kind of being critical of externalities as a way to think about stuff. And to me, it felt strange because I thought that externalities are actually a very useful concept. And maybe there's a better way to account for them. And the other question that is kind of connected to that is, should it be like outsourced to third-party certification entities like B Corp or something like that? And if so, then how can we improve that? Or what kind of third-party certification can be more successful?
Sure. I think the concept of externalities is troubling because if you look at it, implicit in there is that the corporation and maximizing returns to capital, that's the center of the universe. Everything else is external to that. That's kind of imperialist, right? Sort of says, you know, you're white wealthy people in Europe are the center of the world. And, you know, we use it under imperialism, entire nations were considered the possessions of empire. And I think that was unquestioned, I think, in the cultural narrative for a long time. And I think the idea of externalities has a similar kind of who's central and who's peripheral, right? And so I think we need probably better language. And what I think we need to point to is the issue of power, right? So, you know, is a capital-centric corporation going to hire auditors, you know, to go, for example, audit factories overseas? Well, you know, maybe we should say, well, no, companies need to be B Corps. They need to have a commitment to the broader public good in their governing body. Some companies are putting representatives of nature on their governing board. Elizabeth Warren has floated legislation, the Accountable Capitalism Act, to say that 40% of board seats ought to be reserved for workers. So that all corporations ought to have like a federal charter. If you're over $1 billion, this is her legislation. You need a federal charter with a commitment to many stakeholders. So I think this issue of power is one that we need to focus on, and not just, you know, what can the capital-centric corporation do that makes this behavior a little less bad? I'm not terribly optimistic about that, having seen that over 30 years, and it doesn't seem to actually change the nature of things. If the company still thinks its primary focus is maximizing returns to shareholders, and if the only voice on the board is shareholders, and if the pay of the CEO is set in terms of stock price, well, then all of the incentives are aligned in one way. And I think little tiny little auditing off to the side or reporting is really not going to change the nature of what's going on.
Thank you. You know, I'm about to go from this session to meeting with my students at the Media Economies Design Lab here at CU. And, you know, I'm really preoccupied with how best to, you know, prepare students to both, you know, have livelihoods of their own and also participate in this movement you've done so much to build. How do you think about teaching the young and mm-hmm. and supporting and mentoring in a context where we are holding anger, frustration, mourning, a sense of our own mistakes, mm-hmm. a sense of possibility that, you know, we're still working out? You know, how do we support mm-hmm. people just entering into this work?
It's a challenge. I used to do a lot of lecturing in business schools, and you know, when the Divine Right of Capital came out, and that was 20 years ago. And so the Divine Right of Capital is questioning the whole paradigm of shareholder primacy, right? And so, but business schools are in the business of teaching shareholder primacy because that's the world that students are going to be in when they go out. And so what I used to say to students is, you know, when you graduate from here, you're probably going to need to get a job at a place where you're going to be maximizing returns to shareholders. And so I think the school is right to teach you how to function in that. I said, but just for today, let's envision that there could be a different world. And what would that be? And let's open our imagination. Now, that's what I was saying 20 years ago, Nathan. I think we need to say something sharper than that now. I think what we're talking about is a new paradigm of the economy that's emerging. And we need to be serious about that. This is system change. So there's going to be a different purpose at the core of the new system. And the purpose is life, right? Why does an economy exist? To help us live. We need houses. We need food. You know, that's what the economy is about. It's not about adding up digits in the bank accounts of wealthy people. So we're on the cusp of a new paradigm, and it's going to be young people who are going to have to build it. So I think we probably need to teach them to be bilingual. You know, you're going to need to go out and live in this world as it is right now. Hopefully it's not going to be this way forever. So, you know, here's what the new paradigm is about. And here's the old paradigm, which you may need to come to terms with. You need to understand the system so that then you can go in and transform it. But I think that we are talking about a new paradigm, and a paradigm shift is disruptive. If some of you have read about the paradigm shift in physics, when we went from the worldview that told us the world is made of little ball bearings, you know, called atoms, and then we realized, no, that isn't true. That's all wrong. It's just energy. It's just flows of energy. And this really blew the mind of physicists. I mean, they proved this, you know, scientifically, and it was very disruptive, and it was very disturbing to people that their whole worldview had been shattered. I think that we're at that kind of a moment, that the worldview of maximizing returns to shareholders is shattering. And I think we're going to continue to see it shatter. And so what is the new paradigm? And yet, you know, can every business student go out tomorrow and get a job in the new paradigm? Well, no, probably not. But also, I think one of the things we need to teach people is, you know, if you do start a new business, and many MBAs will, don't sell to the highest bidder. Don't take venture capital money, you know, unless it's completely values aligned, and think about selling to workers or creating a B Corp, or, you know, if we create something and then we sell it into the maw of big capital, we're part of the problem. And so I think young entrepreneurs need to learn early. You need a different exit. You need to build an organization that will sustain its mission over time beyond the founder.
Thank you so much. I think that's a beautiful way to wrap up. We're right at the hour. So this is, you know, a conversation I'm so grateful for. I've learned so much from you over the years, and your turn in this direction, you know, I think comes at a really crucial moment, as you say here. This book is extraordinary. I really recommend all of you go out and get it if you haven't yet. It's available wherever books are. And Marjorie, thank you for sharing these reflections, these really honest reflections on your career and where you are now. Thank you all for coming. And I'm so sorry we weren't able to get to every question. They started coming in at the end, some really good ones. But thank you for being part of this conversation.
Thanks, Nathan. And thanks, everyone.
You have been listening to KGNU's Looks Like New, a show that asks old questions about new tech. Nathan Schneider, along with a live audience, have been speaking to Marjorie Kelly about the next generation of enterprise design, employee ownership, and building a community-rooted democratic economy. I'm Alexander Lipka, a new producer here at KGNU. Looks Like New is a radio/podcast production of CU Boulder's Media Economies Design Lab. You can find more of our work at colorado.edu/medlab. Subscribe and find past shows at lookslikenew.net. If you liked what you heard, help spread the word and consider leaving a review wherever you tune into podcasts. We'd love to hear from you about comments and guest ideas. You can reach us at medlab@colorado.edu. We hope you join us next month.